Welcome to History Here and Now. I'm Thomas, the voice inside your podcast machine, and today is a great day to learn about history. The History Here and Now podcast is dedicated to bringing you great stories from the past. Here we talk about people, places, events, culture, and practically every other facet involved with history. Does it sound complicated? Well, history is just that, complicated, but it doesn't have to be. I'm here to help break things down and make history more fun, so let's get started. Now, if you recall from a previous episode, we talked about the life of a character from the American West by the name of Orrin Porter Rockwell. Not only was he a famous lawman rounding up all sorts of criminals in the old American West, serving as a scout, as a friend of the Native American tribes out west, he was also noted for his heavy involvement in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or known by many others as the Mormons. Now, his life early on spent most of his time in Missouri and Illinois, and he was a trusted confidant and bodyguard to the first president of the church, Joseph Smith Jr. Unfortunately, with Smith's martyrdom in the mid-1840s and the church's subsequent move out west, this is now the second part of Rockwell's life. Now here we go today. Joseph Smith, prophet, seer, and revelator, and the first president of the church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, in the summer of 1844, was dead. He and his brother Hiram were killed by a mob at the Carthage jail. His close friend and bodyguard, Orrin Porter Rockwell, was distraught and his mind was plagued with depression. From out of this anguish, Rockwell threw himself into a new horizon. He threw his lot behind Brigham Young, the next president of the church, and began the westward migration to the Rocky Mountains. With another home taken from them with the prophet's death, the saints sought to establish a new Zion far away from the influence of any state or federal government. They heard stories about the Great Salt Lake Valley and the Great Basin and knew that this would be a great starting point for them. Now, Rockwell did not start his new phase off on the right foot. After a brief stint in jail for the murder of Frank Worrell, who, if you remember from the last episode, led the Carthage Grades militia, who indirectly allowed for the martyrdom of Joseph Smith, he regrouped with Brigham Young and other saints in Council Bluffs, Iowa, in August 1846. Now, working in the hands of God to shepherd the church, Young sought out one person who would fight tooth and nail to be a provider for the church. That same year, Young called Rockwell to be his personal bodyguard. But protecting the new president wouldn't be his only duty. For months, church leaders were assembling supplies and making preparations for a mass westward migration. They expected to battle the natural elements and encounter hostile Indian tribes. Rockwell and a handful of other frontiersmen were the vanguard of the Saints' column. Now, after moving to winter quarters, Nebraska, earlier in their year, on the first leg of their westward journey, companies of Saints were assembled to break out across the plains in groups of 10. And these were part of what we had covered in an earlier episode, were the beginnings of the modern handcart companies. Rockwell was attached to the 10th group in line and was immediately made a chief scout for the entire column. It was during this trek that Rockwell made himself indispensable through his adept marksmanship. He fended off groups of Pawnee Indians, he kept the company's horses from escaping, and managed to shoot a couple of buffalo, providing much-needed food for the pioneers, because the pioneers at this time could only take a minimum amount of goods with them on their handcarts in order to keep the weight down. And of course, at this time, Rockwell himself was made himself even more indispensable to the church leadership. One incident was that when Brigham Young misplaced his spyglass, Rockwell backtracked through the company, located it, and returned to Young, which was described as a source of joy to all the brethren. Continuing on their journey, the saints also encountered Missourians traveling west, among whom they thought was Lilburn Boggs making his way to California. And of course, if you remember from the first leg of Rockwell's life, you'll know that he and Boggs were, well, let's put it bluntly, they were not friends. They were enemies. And in fact, Rockwell himself was considered, you know, the alleged assassin when Boggs was almost died a couple of years prior. Now, despite their animosities, the church managed to profit from the Missouri wagon trains by charging them for crossing the rivers on Mormon ferries. Cash-strapped church members and leaders would soon need these funds to build their new settlements. And by July of the next year, the Saints passed into the Rocky Mountains and were winding their way through the labyrinth of rivers, valleys, and deserts to the Great Basin beyond the horizon. Rockwell led a scouting party seeking out the best trail for wagons, and on July 22, 1847, Rockwell and his band led the train into the valley, and there they gazed upon the Great Salt Lake. And it's believed that Rockwell himself was the first to see the vast basin suitable for the new home and recognize the valley's potential. And even then, now at the start of their arrival in their new home, there would be no more rest for Rockwell. Not when more saints needed protection and guidance crossing the plains, and the church would go under new development in the Salt Lake Valley. They quickly began plotting out this new city's grids, their roads, where they would build. Church buildings, hospitals, everything they would need to have in their new Zion. Rockwell made multiple treks across the plains, providing the companies with food and delivering much-needed correspondence. His diplomatic skills with local Indian tribes also became valuable and pivotal in building friendly relationships through trade. Now, after riding all over the Western Territories, Rockwell was made an emissary as part of a larger group to gather more supplies and livestock from California. A successful return of cattle, wagons, mules, and other supplies were a life-giving boost to the Saints. Now, the next year, gold fever would hit the nation with the discovery of gold in Sutter's Mill, and thousands of prospectors would then set out for California, signaling the start of the California Gold Rush. Now, there had already been a colony of saints in California led by a man by the name of Sam Brannan, and he reported on the stupendous amount of wealth being claimed by the miners. Now, Sam Brannan wanted to have the church get in on this in order to acquire the much-needed funds they would need to continue building their new settlements, but Young dissuaded most of the people of the church to seek such fortunes because he believed it would lead them into sinful practice. Things like gambling and prostitution and drinking, all that went hand-in-hand in the mining camps in California, and Young tried to do his best to keep his church members from falling into that. But tithing was needed to conduct church business. And tithing, for those who don't know, tithing is giving a percentage of your earned profits to the church for church business. And those in California weren't carrying their share of tithing at that time. However, profits from more respectable and reliable ventures were more prudent, and Rockwell was dispatched to California in the spring of 1849. He and his companion, Amasa Lyman, spent their time spreading the gospel and conducting business with the miners. And this was a common practice during the gold rush and the mid-19th centuries. Now, you had those miners who were risking their life savings or possibly even the savings of other people, you know, going out and hopefully striking it rich on a gold claim. But you also had those who were selling to the miners, taking all their money to begin with. You had those who were, you know, selling all the clothing, all the food, all the hardware and tools that you would need, you know, to dig and pan for gold in the rivers. Now, predictably, business fared much better than religious enlightenment in the mining camps, so Rockwell, profiting off of this, opened an inn and sold hardware, winning prize money also with his sharpshooting skills. And by the time Rockwell left California in the fall of 1850, he had made a generous profit, all of which he had donated then back to the church. And in fact, there's a story that his old enemy, Lilburn Boggs, was also in the gold fields, but Rockwell never let his identity be known. He always used a pseudonym and never traveled without his dual pistols in order to keep him from stirring up any trouble. Now, whether Lilburn Boggs or Porter Rockwell had ever met during their time out in California, we'll never know, but it's probably good that they avoided each other. Now, the next 5 years were relatively stable and sedentary for Porter. On September 9, 1850, Brigham Young appointed him as a deputy marshal for the Utah Territory. Between tracking down criminals and treating local Indian tribes with civility, now this was different from others at the time, white at this time, because his belief was to feed an Indian rather than to shoot him, he found love again and married Mary Ann Neff on May 3rd, 1854. Brigham Young himself officiated the wedding, And from 1854 onwards, though, it would be become the most accomplished yet checkered stage of Porter's life, one that could be the subject of many dime store novels. 3 years later, in 1857, relations between the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the U.S. government were arguably at their lowest point. Newly inaugurated President James Buchanan, who was elected on a platform of ending polygamy in the United States, a polygamy which was practiced by some members of the church, but not all of them, he was adamant in restraining Brigham Young's Western theocracy. He appointed Alfred Cumming to replace Young as the territorial governor, but failed to notify him of this change. An expedition of 2,500 soldiers under the command of Colonel Albert Sidney Johnston were sent west with orders to forcibly remove Young if necessary. Now, Rockwell, who had actually landed a job delivering mail for the Pony Express, him and two other couriers, Abraham Smoot and Judson Stoddard, discovered that the army was en route to Salt Lake City and quickly returned to inform Young of this pending doom. Now, church leaders and civil authorities adopted a guerrilla strategy in striking at the heels of the Utah expedition. They attacked supply lines, they would steal wagons and animals, they would destroy ferries and river crossings, anything to slow down their advance. Rockwell and men like Lott Smith and Daniel Wells led these raids, and these were the first in church attacks against the federal government. They would roar through camps, stampeding animals and setting fire to wagons. But their havoc was not limited to the patrols and scouting parties. They would even attack some sizable forts and supply depots that Rockwell himself would order them to be torched. When the army reached Fort Bridger in December of 1857, the calm that did arrive was half-starved, frostbitten, and short on everything from cooking lard to gunpowder. Now, sabotage and stealth proved well for Rockwell and other scouts in the Utah War, skills that became crucial for the next conflict on the horizon, the American Civil War. Now, Joseph Smith, many years before, had received a revelation and prophesied that a crisis over secession would take place in the South, specifically mentioning South Carolina, and a civil war would engulf the nation. Now, Utah's remoteness did not completely spare the people from the ravages of warfare. You know, many Civil War texts can tell you we'll always focus on the battles out east in Virginia and Maryland and Tennessee and Missouri and even places in Kentucky and further south. But the war out west, beyond that, in the Trans-Mississippi, was a bare-knuckle guerrilla war. Within the first few months of the war's outbreak in 1861, Confederate columns pushed into New Mexico territory, signaling the start of hostilities in the American Southwest. Now, fortunately for the LDS Church and Utah residents, there were no major Confederate invasions into their territory, but raids by local Native American tribes on farms, army posts, and mail routes were some of the biggest engagements. Now, with the absence of U.S. troops from much of the West, tribes like the Shoshone, Sioux, Apache, and Cheyenne felt emboldened to strike back at white pioneers. Now, those like Port Rockwell, who maintained good friendships with local tribes, were employed as mediators to help resolve conflicts or relocate people if needed. In January 1863, tensions between the Union Army and the Shoshone tribes reached a climax at Bear River. Rockwell signed on to work for the federal government again, but this time he acted as a scout for the column of Union soldiers moving through the Utah and Idaho territories. California volunteers under the command of Colonel Patrick Connor and Major McGarry attacked Shoshone Indians in the Cache Valley, resulting in tremendous losses for the Indians. While Connor was pleased with the destruction of the Shoshone, Rockwell was devastated at what he called an orgy of violence that unfolded. He always believed that the Indians should have been treated with civility and hospitality, but he himself admitted that his role in the Bear Creek Massacre was something he would always regret throughout his life. Now, Western territories in the 19th century were wide open and an opportunity for both pioneers and outlaws. In a wide swath of territory like Utah and Nevada and Wyoming, Brigham Young's choice to make Rockwell a marshal was one that he believed would bring all God-fearing criminals to justice. And obviously, as we will soon find out, there's a lot of truth to that. Throughout Rockwell's tenure as marshal, he arrested dozens of thieves, scofflaws, vagrants, and other nefarious characters. There are many stories like these of lawmen catching criminals in the West, but they've been so embellished with romantic imagery or severe criticism based on the central character, and that's almost impossible to determine the hard truth. What really transpired is known only to those directly involved. In 1868, an Overland stagecoach for Wells Fargo was robbed of $40,000 in gold bullion. As the robber made his way on foot, Rockwell, employed as a coach guard, actually set out to find the thief. He tracked down the man for a week and spent another week observing the man's behavior. The bullion was buried, and when he returned to exhume the treasure, Rockwell swooped in and arrested him. He put him under guard at Government Creek, and when the guard fell asleep, the thief escaped on horseback, and Rockwell failed to take him out via a long-shot rifle. When he returned the gold to Salt Lake City, Wells Fargo officials initially believed that Rockwell was this thief himself stealing the gold, because he failed to bring back the criminal in for any charges. Now, whether they believe he stole the gold or not, Rockwell was never charged, and the case of the Great Bullion Robbery inflated the controversial legend of Border Rockwell. And in another story, in 1857, a group of gamblers named the Aiken Brothers were apprehended by Rockwell, some of whom ended up dead while being escorted out of the Salt Lake Valley. Initially, their deaths were blamed on the local Indians, but church critics placed blame squarely on Rockwell. Nearly two decades later, formal charges were brought against him for the Aiken brothers' murder, and with the recent death of Brigham Young, Rockwell had reason to fear that he'd be thrown in jail again. Now, Rockwell died before the trial was held, but the jury failed to conclude whether or not any murder took place. Some historians today believe that the Aiken brothers actually were killed by Indians, but the true story has been laid to rest in the grave. Now, Rockwell, throughout all this time, when he's out arresting or tracking down criminals, whether he's either that or working for the U.S. government or working as a scout or working with local Indians or conducting any other kind of church business, I mean, honestly, Rockwell's schedule sounds a lot busier than mine. He was also a savvy businessman. On top of carrying mail for the Overland routes and hauling cargo across the Utah Territory and also working as a Wells Fargo contractor, wow, his schedule is a lot busier than mine. He was involved in the liquor trade, operated a saloon and hotel, sold real estate, and raised livestock. Now, when he was involved in the liquor trade, of course, the church did not condone the consumption of hard liquor at the time, but that didn't mean he couldn't, you know, sell it to those in Utah who weren't members of the church. He ran a business called the Hot Springs Hotel and Brewery, which he opened in 1859, and at the time, the business made Rockwell a substantial amount of money, much of which he reinvested in land and ranching businesses. And near the end of his life, Rockwell was arguably one of the richest people in Utah. He lived a long life filled with adventure, challenges, and spiritual conviction. From his early days witnessing the creation of the LDS Church to Joseph Smith's martyrdom and his pursuit of the law in the wild Utah Territory, Rockwell was a weary man at the age of 65. And despite his age, he was still a robust figure who regularly rode horses and kept busy with his ranches and other businesses. Now remember, he's doing all this and the man doesn't know how to read or write. I mean, it's amazing what he was able to accomplish. Of course, it also means that he never left behind a diary or journal, and so pretty much all of his life story is taken secondhand. On June 8, 1878, he returned from a trip to the theater and sat alone at his saloon drinking. By now, drinking alone was a habit of Porter's. He regularly drank throughout his life, and despite the church's abolition against hard liquors, he still imbibed now and then. Later that evening, he began to feel ill and collapsed on his bed. A hostler who ran the nearby livery stable quickly came to his side and called for a doctor. Porter laid in his bed for hours, but no relief from the pain ever came. On June 9th, 1878, Orrin Porter Rockwell, bodyguard of the prophets, the destroying angel of martyrdom, Samson of the church, died of congestive heart failure. Now, public reaction to his death was polarizing. People who knew him said he was a faithful defender of the church and a righteous man who protected the innocent. He brought criminals to justice. He did everything by choosing the right. Church critics and other anti-Mormon persons called him the most vile man to ever kill people without just cause. Now, an anti-Mormon newspaper operating out of Utah ran an obituary describing Rockwell as, quote, "He killed unsuspecting travelers whose booty was coveted by his prophet master. He killed fellow saints who held secrets that menaced the safety of their fellow criminals in the priesthood. He killed apostates who dared to wag their tongues about the wrongs they had endured, and he killed more sojourners in Zion merely to keep his hand in. Thus the gallows was cheated of one of the fittest candidates that ever cut a throat or plundered a traveler. But the legacy of Porter Rockwell is long and a complicated one, to say the least. Stories about his life embody a time of persecution, retribution, revenge, endurance, sorrow, and cherishing joy. Critics were always at his heels haranguing him for his vicious deeds, the abominable chief of the day knights they constantly reminded to the public. But his life is not limited to the contemporary critics or the historical revisionists re-examining the narratives and casting him in a better light. Rockwell, at his core, was a man guided by every mission bestowed upon him with reverence for the church's callings. He stood at the prophet's side in every ordeal and brought sinners to justice. Now, if these words are apt in summarizing his legacy, Joseph F. Smith, later becoming a president of the church and nephew of Joseph Smith Jr., delivered Rockwell's eulogy on June 12, 1878, putting to words the impact left by Rockwell on his former saints. They say he was a murderer. If he was the friend of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, and he was faithful to them and to his covenants, and he has gone to heaven and apostates can go to hell. Porter Rockwell was yesterday afternoon ushered into heaven, clothed with an immortality and eternal life, and crowned with all glory which belongs to a departed saint. He has his little faults, but Porter's life on earth, taken altogether, was one of worthy example, and reflected honor upon the church. Through all his trials, he never once forgot his obligations to his brethren and his God. I really hope you enjoyed that story, because History Here and Now is a website dedicated to the research and writing about different historical topics. And if you like this podcast, hit the like button, share it on social media, and recommend it to your friends, families, colleagues, anyone you think would enjoy a good discussion. You can follow History Here and Now on Twitter and check back periodically for the next episode. And until then, good luck, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.